Our next speaker is Professor Kevin Ruain. Kevin is Professor of Modern History at Canterbury Christ Church University. He's a bi-fellow of Churchill College, Cambridge. This is his third appearance at the festival. He completes his hat trick today. He came in 2012 and 2017 and gave us numerous insights into the history surrounding the Quiet American and Green's involvement and relationship with the Indochina War. Kevin has published widely on post-war international history. In 2016, he published Churchill and the Bomb, which was named one of the books of the year by BBC History Magazine and The Times. He's currently working on a history of the final years of the French War in Vietnam and a project on Green, which is provisionally titled Graham Greene's Vietnam War. You can access some of Kevin's research in our journal, Graham Greene Studies, which we published 2 years ago now, and we're hoping to bring another volume of that out in due course. So that is well worth checking out. And I believe Kevin's hoping to publish his book on Green in 2021-22. So we do look forward to that. That will be another really solid, authoritative source on the life, times, Green. So without further ado, Kevin, please can I welcome you to the stage. Thank you.
Phew. We've become very reliant on PowerPoint these days. If the images aren't there, I sweat too much. Thank you, Martin, for that kind introduction, and thank you all for coming along. It is my hat trick. It's fantastic to be back. On my first visit in 2012, I dwelt on what seemed to me to be a curious thing about this novel, The Quiet American, that in and after 1955, so many people seem to invest this work of fiction, which is relating to the French War in Indochina, drawing on Green's own personal experiences, how so many people seem to read chunks of it as fact, as history. Green himself rather feared that something like that might happen. He knew that there were significant chunks of what we might call reportage in this novel, you know, drawn straight from the journals that he carried with him over three, four visits to Vietnam. On the right-hand side of the screen is a journal page with his incredibly crabby, if he's not writing for anybody else, only for himself, his writing is incredibly difficult to decode. Now, he knew there was going to be a lot of this stuff in it. But despite warning his readers in the frontispiece of the novel that he'd written a story and not a piece of history, quote unquote, this tendency to invest it with some kind of historical authenticity just kept going. So anyway, that's what I dwelt on in 2012. 2 years ago, I introduced you to the man on the right, Trevor Wilson, Green's friendship with Trevor Wilson. Trevor Wilson on the right is a very badly pixelated picture, but there's not many of Trevor Wilson. He's sitting there with the Bishop of Phat Diem in northern Vietnam around about 1951. Trevor Wilson was our man in Hanoi, and I know that if you study Green for any length of time, there's an our man almost everywhere around the world. But this was our man in Hanoi. Trevor Wilson was the UK consul in northern Vietnam in 1951 when Graham Greene arrives in Vietnam for the first time. More than that, Trevor Wilson was on MI6's payroll. He was a spy. In demeanour and physical resemblance, more like Captain Mannering, I think I may have said a couple of years ago, than James Bond. But nonetheless, do not let don't judge a book or a spy by its cover. Green and Trevor Wilson met each other during the Second World War, working for the Secret Intelligence Service anyway, and their friendship endured. So that's what I was up to 2 years ago. Graham Greene struck out for Southeast Asia for the first time around about the end of 1950. He went off to Malaya to see his brother Hugh Carlton Greene, who was involved on the propaganda side of this thing called the Malayan Emergency, a communist-led rebellion against British colonial rule in Malaya. But Green was also in Malaya with a rather lucrative commission from the American Life magazine to write an article on the war. On the right, by the way, is Green about to head off on a 2 or 3 day stomp into the jungles in the heart of Pahang, and he's looking pretty spruce and chipper in the photograph. I can tell you by the end of that trek, he was looking anything but. Now, Green decided to break his journey home from Malaya to England by popping over to Indochina to see his old chum from the war years, Trevor Wilson, who was on the Foreign Office's payroll officially, but was picking up a rather nice retainer from MI6. And what larks they got up to. I'm not going to go through them now. I do believe you can listen to this talk, or the talk I gave 2 years ago, via the festival's audio archive. Now, on Green's first visit to Vietnam in January 1951, he stayed only a fortnight, which was long enough to send a few postcards and to get into quite a lot of mischief. But three more lengthy visits ensued over the next 3 to 4 years, inspired partly by his love of the country and its peoples, and it was pretty much love at first sight for Graham Greene, and also paid for by more lucrative journalistic commissions. He was paid by the likes of the Sunday Times, Paris Match, and Life again. Which makes Graham Greene, in his own way, does it not, a Vietnam War reporter. Not the American War, but the French War. And that, of course, is my main theme today. Well, it will be when I get to it properly. I want to concentrate on the importance of the Quiet American to the generation of war reporters who went to Vietnam from the early 60s. Mostly, but not exclusively, American and female, and it comes as a surprise to the casual observer how many female war correspondents did operate in Vietnam, female as well as male correspondents, who went when the American war was beginning to bubble in the early 60s and stayed on reporting it after 1965 when it really gets going in earnest. Those of you who may be interested, from the left we have Kate Webb. Then we have David Halberstam, Malcolm Brown, Neil Sheehan, and on the right-hand picture, Wally Bean and Peter Arnett. A number of luminaries of the trade there, and I'm going to be talking about a few of those as I go along. But before I get into that too deeply, a couple of things need to happen. One, I need to give you a little bit of history. I need to take you from this French war that Green experienced to the war that these men and women ended up reporting. And I also need to take you very briefly through the plot of The Quiet American, which means if you've not read The Quiet American, it means I'm going to entirely spoil the plot of The Quiet American for you, but I'm not sure I can do this talk in any other way. Now, by the time of Graham Greene's first visits, plural, to Vietnam in 1951, the Indochina War, that's to say, Vietnam is the crucible of this war, but it spills over into Laos and Cambodia, so we get the Indochina War. The war between France, colonial France, and the communist-led nationalists of the Viet Minh is in its fifth year, and it's not going well for France. What began in 1946 as a colonial war, with the Viet Minh seeking to prize freedom from the grip of colonial France, had been transformed by 1951, when Green turns up, into an Asian Cold War hot war. In the first place, China, recently communized to the north of Vietnam, is supplying the Viet Minh with arms, material assistance. No troops, but just military assistance. And from 1950, the United States is doing likewise for France. Initially, I ought to say the Americans were rather reluctant to back the colonial French. The United States took its pride, took its heritage as an anti-colonial state, 1776 and all that, very seriously, regarding itself as more a champion of freedom for oppressed or enslaved colonial peoples, not the prop for some rickety European imperial empire. But 1950, when American aid begins for France, this was the Cold War. France's enemy, the Viet Minh, was led by the man on the right of the screen, Ho Chi Minh, a veteran revolutionary, Moscow-trained communist. And thirdly, American Cold War strategists in 1950 took a map of Southeast Asia out, and they pinpointed Vietnam as the trigger domino of what would become publicly known in 1954 as the domino theory. The country whose loss to communism would set off this grievous chain reaction, leading to the loss of all of Southeast Asia, and a pretty big shift in the global balance towards the communist bloc. So, the domino theory, or if you prefer the octopus theory, it all amounts to the same thing. Contemporary magazine, or a contemporary magazine cartoon there on the left, showing you the tentacles of this communist octopus radiating out of China and reaching down south towards British Malaya and, of course, Indochina. And so, for Cold War reasons, from 1950, US aid began to flow to the French for use in Indochina. Mountains of US military aid. No troops, but guns, napalm, aircraft. And with the aid comes a lot of Americans, military advisors, those whose job it is to run the thing on the right, or at least that's a badge of the thing on the right, the American Military Assistance Advisory Group, MARG, which is based in southern Vietnam, in Saigon. So lots of military aid. But in 1950, along with the military aid, the United States insists on giving the French non-military aid. We might almost call it humanitarian aid. This is partly to salve America's the Truman administration's anti-colonial conscience. It gives the arms, but it also sends civilians, doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, agricultural specialists, whose real job is to improve the lot of the ordinary Vietnamese. This was a condition that the French had to take on. Now, the French in 1950-51 are delighted to take the military assistance, but they hate having to put up with this influx of American civilian administrators as well. And before long, the colonial leadership in Vietnam, the French, are beginning to think the Americans really want to Americanize their war, and at the very least, the Americans want to undermine their control of their colony. So there's real tension in this Franco-American relationship. During Green's 4 visits to Vietnam, and here he is having a little bit of fun, with French troops on the left at Phat Diem, or he's smiling at least. It was a grim visit in other ways. Graham Greene tended to hang out mostly with the French, whether they're soldiers or civilians. And I think in the novel, he does give us this Franco-American tension, but to the extent he gives it to us through Thomas Fowler, the English narrator for the most part, I think Greene's sympathies are more with the French than the Americans. And that brings me on, by the way, then, to a little bit about the plot. And I've got as the background to it the two movie posters. Graham Greene hated that 1957 version, absolutely hated it. He didn't live to see the 2002 version, obviously. But I have this as a sort of backdrop as I trot through the plot slightly. Now, the principal characters, as I've just said, are Thomas Fowler, a cynical and opium-addled from time to time British reporter working out of Saigon in the south of Vietnam in the French War, and then Alden Pyle, the idealistic and committed American Cold Warrior, the quiet American of the title. And Pyle is a member of the economic mission that is attached to the US legation in South Vietnam, so Pyle is one of these non-military American aid administrators, if you like, who come in from 1950. In the novel, Pyle is eventually outed as a CIA agent who is secretly promoting a political and military third force, as it was called. Third force in Vietnam, one that will stand between the French colonialists on one side and the communist-led rebels on the other, a third force. In real life, in the early 50s, the American government did wonder and worry that the French might call it quits, cut and run from a war that was costing France so much in blood and treasure, despite all that American aid. And in the novel, that's replicated. The Americans, basically Pyle, working behind French backs, are trying to identify alternative anti-communist leadership around which the Nhân and anti-communist Vietnamese could rally if the French throw the sponge in and go home. It's an insurance policy for the future. And in The Quiet American, Pyle, that is, finds the Third Force in the form of the shadowy General Tay. Now, General Tay was real. He was funded, historians now show, by the CIA, and Graham Greene knew all about General Tay. This is General Tay, by the way, on the right. He looks about 12 years of age, but he was one of the military commanders of a religious sect in South Vietnam known as the Cao Dai. Sect doesn't really convey its importance. It had over 2 million adherents. This is big stuff, and Graham Greene encountered the Cao Dai on a number of occasions. General Tay, commander of the Cao Dai, or one of the commanders of the Cao Dai military, broke from the mainstream sect in June 1951, smack in the middle of Greene's first two visits, and Tay took himself off into the jungle with CIA money, set up radio stations, set up a new organization that was both anti-French and anti-communist, right in the middle, pro-nationalist, but of a non-communist ilk. Now, in the novel, it's Fowler's discovery that Pyle is an undercover CIA operative that will seal Pyle's fate. The key moment comes when a massive car bomb explodes in the center of Saigon, killing and maiming many innocent bystanders. And Fowler recognizes very quickly shades of Laurence Olivier, Marathon Man, Dentist's Chair. Always gets me, that drilling sound. The key moment comes when a car bomb explodes, center of Saigon, killing and injuring many, many, many people. Fowler recognizes the handiwork of General Tay, the American Third Force. Therefore, he recognizes the handiwork of Alden Pyle. Now, that bombing took place. It was a real event. It took place on the 9th of January, 1952, and it does form the backdrop to the climactic final stages of the novel. In the novel, Pyle and Fowler are on this scene within moments of the explosion, and Pyle is stunned. "It's awful," he says, surveying the carnage, and then he glances down at his shoe. "What's that?" he asks, quite puzzled. "Blood," Fowler tells him. "Haven't you seen it before? You've got the Third Force all over your right shoe." Fowler decides in the novel that the time has come to do something about this meddling American before he does even more harm. But Fowler is also bitter, and I'm sure you know this, because Pyle's done something else quite bad. He has stolen away from Fowler, Phong, his young Vietnamese mistress. That's the love angle. So whether it's from political conviction or jealousy or an admixture of both, Fowler uses his own shady contacts with the Viet Minh to arrange, essentially, to have Alden Pyle bumped off. "He was a good chap in his way, a quiet American," Fowler tells Monsieur Vigo, the French detective charged with investigating the murder. "A very quiet American," Vigo agrees. Now, the novel's real time setting is 1951 and 1952. You can work that out. The clues are all over it. And that reflects Vietnam as Graham Greene encountered it on his first two visits, January 51 and a later visit straddling late 51 into early 52. By 1954, Graham Greene visit number three, despite all that American assistance, the French are really done for. In May 1954, and my slides reflect this somewhat, the French are defeated by the Viet Minh at the Make or Break Battle of Dien Bien Phu in northwest Vietnam. The French, broken now and demoralized, decide to negotiate their way out of Vietnam on the best terms they can get. To the annoyance of the United States, which had been supplying the French, who want the French to fight on, the French have had enough. The map in the middle reflects the Vietnam peace settlement of July 1954. The war ends. The French withdraw from the North with their followers, in inverted commas. The North is given over to Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh. Vietnam is partitioned at the 17th parallel. Elections, however, are written into the diary. There will be, in July 1956, all Vietnam elections, internationally supervised for fair play, after which, 1956, a single Vietnamese government will emerge, that dividing line will be erased, the French will disappear from the south as they've already gone from the north, and Vietnam will move forward, united, free and independent, and enjoy a harmonious and happy future as a state. It doesn't happen that way, does it? The first thing is those elections do not take place in 1956. The Eisenhower administration, that's President Dwight D. Eisenhower on the left of the screen, the Eisenhower administration worries that the Viet Minh are going to win those 1956 elections. And in the context of the Cold War, the United States feels that maybe a permanent partition of Vietnam is better than risking a united Vietnam, which might drift into or become communist. In October 1954, the Eisenhower administration launches what it was called at the time, it's in the documents, this is what it was called, a nation-building project to build, quite literally, a separate South Vietnamese state that will be anti-communist, democratic, liberal, capitalist, if at all possible. Nation-building. And the man the United States chose to front this program, the Vietnamese leader, politician, is the man on the right of the screen, Ngo Dinh Diem. Ngo Dinh Diem was a visceral anti-communist. He was a fervent Roman Catholic. And from an American point of view, from late 1954, forget about General Tay and the Cao Dai, the Catholics of South Vietnam are where they see the greatest anti-communist resistance coming, moving forward. Having said that, historians who work on this now agree that America's Vietnam experts in 1954 didn't give a great deal of thought to the potentially incendiary implications of backing Ngo Dinh Diem, a Roman Catholic fundamentalist, intolerant, publicly intolerant of other faiths, in a country where 80% of the population identified as Buddhist, to a greater, that's to say actually practicing degree, or a lesser degree, insofar as they at least were spiritually or emotionally connected to Buddhism. The slide, by the way, shows Diem on the right, shaking hands with New York's Cardinal Spellman, has Diem in the middle at his devotions, and on the left is his brother, Ngo Dinh Thuc, who was the Archbishop of Hue, and therefore the leading Catholic figure in Vietnam at this time. So it's not just Diem, it is a family issue from that point of view. This religious stuff will actually get quite important. Graham Greene met Diem on his final visit, 1955, and Graham Greene wrote of his co-religionist that he was, quote, a bit of a madman to the extent that he wished to push his religion. Trouble loomed, Greene felt. And so it goes in South Vietnam down to the 1960s, the early 60s. It just happened to be on President John F. Kennedy's watch, it's JFK on the left there, that the Vietnamese communists, having bided their time since 1954, decided that the time was now ripe to seek the liberation of South Vietnam, to reforge national unity under Ho Chi Minh and communism, to obtain by the gun and the grenade maybe what they felt they might have had through the ballot box if those 1956 elections had been held. But they're not held because America opted for nation building, a separate South Vietnam. From the early 60s then, this US-backed government in South Vietnam comes under pressure from within, symbolized by a picture on the right, or the two pictures, from the Viet Cong, from the southern, born and bred communist guerrilla movement. But it comes under pressure from without, from communist North Vietnam, which is the aider and abettor-in-chief of the Viet Cong in the south. For the Kennedy administration and for the Johnson administration that will follow after JFK's assassination in 63, South Vietnam remains as it had been for some years now, the trigger domino of Southeast Asia, the domino that had to remain upright. But in the early 60s, South Vietnam is now beginning to wobble in a way it's not done since 1954. South Vietnam becomes very, very, very important to Cold War America. And that importance is reflected in the number of US reporters, not exclusively, largely US reporters that are sent to South Vietnam from the early 1960s onwards. Now, I want you to use your imaginations, if I may ask you to, for a moment. You are one of these reporters. Your news editor senses that something big is brewing down Southeast Asia way. Your editor hands you an airline ticket. You're going to South Vietnam. How do you fill your time on the flight? How do you get up to speed on this thing that is brewing? What do? Okay, you are a student of world affairs by definition. You know a bit about the French War that ended a few years earlier. But there's no actual history books out there. Or if there are history books, they're mostly French, and assuming you have the language skills to read them, will French historians, so close to this raw moment in French history, be terribly objective? What do? What could you read? Well, I think you know where I'm going now, don't you? Well, you are told, or you know anyway, that there's a rather brilliant novel been knocking around for a few years. And even better if you're a travelling journalist, it's quite short, it's compact and it's portable. And it apparently does a very good job of explaining recent Vietnamese history and all these things you need to get up to speed on, albeit within a fictional framing. That's because the author, some guy called, you're going to have to help me again here, some guy called Graham Greene, didn't just write about this French war. He lived it. So you get hold of a copy and you read it. Guess what? It's terrific. You pass it on to other reporters. They read it as well. The book spreads. Today we'd say it goes viral amongst the American journalistic community that is growing by the week in South Vietnam. It becomes a sort of literary Rosetta Stone that helps these journalists to understand why America is in Vietnam, and it will later help them make sense of why things go bad for the United States in Vietnam. You have your favourite passages. Some you might learn off by heart. You learn quotes, you underline bits. Should never underline anything in a book, but maybe you do. Maybe it's this passage in which Fowler, the old Asia hand with years of in-country Asia experience, passes judgment on Pyle, so full of book learning as opposed to life learning or living in Asia learning. Passes judgment about Pyle and his view that the US and the West and democracy are predestined to prevail in the East. Pyle, the personification of a US Indochina policy forged in meeting rooms in the Pentagon or the State Department, far away from Vientiane, Phnom Penh and Hanoi and Saigon. He passes judgment. I never knew a man who had better motives for all the trouble he caused. He was sincere in his way. It was a coincidence that the sacrifices were all paid by others. He was absorbed in the dilemmas of democracy and the responsibilities of the West. He was determined, I learnt that very soon, to do good. Not to any individual person, but to a country, a continent, a world. This identikit reporter I've implanted in your minds, and which you may have added to in the strongholds of your minds, is in fact based very accurately on the real-life experiences of many US Vietnam-era war reporters. It's drawn from their published memoirs or from interviews I have conducted over 25 years, correspondence with a lot of them, many of them now passed on, a few of them not. So let me illustrate that, give you some real reporters. This is David Greenway, who covered the war for Time and the Washington Post, amongst others. Greenway has confirmed how this novel went viral amongst the reporters in South Vietnam. The Quiet American, he wrote, was the most influential novel of my generation in Indochina. As Napoleon Bonaparte wanted a marshal's baton in every private's knapsack, Green's book was in every reporter's knapsack. That's Greenway on the public record. When I interviewed him a few years ago, I suggested rather cautiously that he might have exaggerated how prolifically this novel had spread amongst the journalists in Saigon. He didn't like that. There must have been reporters in Saigon who'd not read The Quiet American, but certainly all my friends had read it, and I was friends of all the reporters, so you go and work it out. So there's always a tense moment in such interviews. In similar vein, this is the much garlanded war correspondent and Pulitzer Prize winner David Halberstam typing away on the floor here of what I assume is probably a Saigon hotel room. This is what Halberstam said in 2003. There wasn't a great literature on Vietnam at that time, meaning the early 60s when he first goes to Vietnam. But certainly Graham Greene's The Quiet American was a very, very important book to the younger generation of reporters to which I belonged. Many passages some of us can quote to this day. It was our Bible. But why was it? What was it that resonated so strongly for Halberstam and others? Another famous US correspondent here, Neil Sheehan. There he is on the second row in the spectacles, Saigon press conference. First of UPI, the reporting agency, and then the New York Times. Neil Sheehan gave an answer to that question. Quote, "The Quiet American wasn't only the best book written about Vietnam, but Green succeeded in showing what Senator Fulbright, doesn't matter for now who he was, called the arrogance of power, a mindset that says, we are going to save you from yourselves." And that's strong stuff. But many other reporters have echoed that. Now, I understand that Gloria Emerson here attended this very festival around about 2001, 2002, about a year before her death. Gloria Emerson was one of an actually quite significant number of female Vietnam War reporters. Others I could name: Oriana Fallaci, Elizabeth Pond, Kate Webb, Marguerite Higgins, Frances Fitzgerald a bit later on. For Gloria Emerson, the novel's message was a bit of a slow reveal. She first went to South Vietnam in 1956. That's just after the French War, just when Eisenhower's backing for Diem is going and nation building is getting going. And she initially shadowed the CIA's John Gates Jr. Now, Emerson remembered Gates being very upset, 1956, by a novel that was just published that was only 247 pages. Its title was The Quiet American by Graham Greene. Now, Emerson and Gates shared a copy of the US edition, which came out in 56. The British edition, I think, came out 1955. Gates thought it was awful, a deliberate attempt to make the Americans look like meatheads and bad guys, as he put it. Well, Emerson felt very differently about the story. It was a first warning to me. But I dismissed the book in the 50s as brilliant but cynical, only for it to come back to haunt me in later years, more than I ever thought such a small, light book ever could. Emerson's experience, reading The Quiet American in the 50s, well, much too cynical. Then Vietnam experience, reading it again in the 60s, resonant, real, revelatory, is not an uncommon reporter experience. This is A.J. Langhoff, Jack Langhoff, who arrived in South Vietnam in 1964. There he is on the right, typing away, and the left in more recent years. He passed away not that long ago, actually. He did three lengthy journalistic tours of duty for the New York Times. And he wrote to me at considerable length a number of years ago, and I'd like to share a few of his rather vivid recollections with you. Quote, all this is Jack Langhoff. "I'd read The Quiet American when it first appeared in the United States in 1956. With the literary certainty of a 23-year-old, I pronounced it far inferior to his earlier work, particularly the heart of the matter. I judged the Asian setting to be well-drawn, but the American character was simply too much a caricature. To me, it was like plopping down a cartoon in the center of a finely wrought etching. Then I went to South Vietnam, and I understood that I owed Graham Greene an apology. Pyle was no cartoon. He was an accurately rendered portrait of many of the young Americans I was meeting there. Reporters are notorious for not reading much that doesn't pertain to their assignments, and I suspect The Quiet American may have been the only Green novel, perhaps the only novel per se, that many of them had read. I'm not sure they even thought of it as fiction. And after a few months in Vietnam, I'm not sure I did either. The photojournalist Malcolm Brown here worked alongside Halberstam, Langlöf and others in the 60s. Of his first stint in the early 60s, Malcolm Brown remembered that, quote, "Even after reading a lot of what passed for news, Vietnam came as quite a surprise to me. But I soon came to see that Graham Greene's memorable novel, The Quiet American, had caught the flavor of Vietnam's war better than any newspaper or magazine article I had read, not least in its all-important political undercurrents." Its all-important political undercurrents. You know, Malcolm Brown here knew whereof he spoke. Malcolm Brown was getting ready for bed late on the evening of the 10th of June, 1963, in a Saigon hotel room when he received a mysterious phone call. It was a tip-off telling Malcolm to get himself and his camera down to a particular intersection of downtown Saigon early the next morning because there was going to be something going on that he ought to photograph. Now, if you are of a squeamish disposition, you might want to avert your eyes, because what Malcolm Brown photographed was one of, or a sequence of, the most disturbing still, yet iconic photographs of the entire Vietnam War era. This is the immolation, or the self-immolation, of a Buddhist monk, the Reverend Quang Duc. The protest was against the religious intolerance of the US-backed Diem regime, alongside the political repression of the US-supported government. The Buddhist protest movement knew that their plight needed to make international headlines, and that's where Brown and his camera came in. More than that, President Kennedy, seeing those photographs in the newspapers the next day, was profoundly shocked. What are we doing, supporting a government that drives its people to protest in such a terrible, terrible way? Even as he posed the question, JFK, I think, had a kind of answer, that back in 1954, in the context of the Cold War, backing Diem seemed logical because of Diem's fierce anti-communism. But 9 years on, police state methods, repression, JFK and his Vietnam advisors concluded that Diem's anti-communism was no longer enough on its own. At any rate, 5 months after Brown's photographs were taken, and of course he wins all kinds of press photograph awards that year, Diem was gone, overthrown in a military coup by Buddhist officers in the South Vietnamese army trained by the United States. Before 1963, of course, is out, JFK is gone as well. And when by 1965, Diem's successors in South Vietnam are struggling still to contain the rising communist threat, the United States under President Johnson takes the fateful decision to Americanize the war, 1965 onwards. And I think most of us know where that story goes. Now, why do I dwell at length on this? I dwell at length on it because I think Graham Greene, in his 1950s war reporting, saw a lot of this coming. As I mentioned earlier, Greene didn't just visit Vietnam in the early 50s, the late French period, just to gather material and impressions and atmosphere to feed into his fiction. He did that, of course. Graham Greene was also paid to go to Vietnam and report on the war. He was paid by Life magazine, The Sunday Times, The Tablet, Paris Match, The Spectator, The Listener, The New Republic, amongst others. And if The Quiet American can and has been read as somehow prophetic, I think some of his journalism can be read as prophetic as well, particularly as it relates to the man on the left, Ngo Dinh Diem. Green, I think I mentioned this earlier, Green met and interviewed Diem in 1955. And he judged Diem to be personally okay, basically honest, but Green was troubled by the zealousness of his attachment to his faith and his intolerance of other faiths, which was not good in a country where some 80% identified or practiced Buddhism, but where Diem and his Catholic-dominated government wielded just about all the political power. Green saw problems coming, and problems there were. In the years that followed, promotion in the South Vietnamese army, for example, tended in the upper echelons to go to Roman Catholics more than Buddhists, irrespective of quality. Preferment within the structures of the South Vietnamese government again went to those most loyal to Diem's family or to Catholicism as opposed to Buddhism. Which means that by 1963, which is when these images relate to, what you've got, historians now are looking at it in these terms, you've got a sort of war of religion in South Vietnam beginning to bubble up, irrespective of anything that the Viet Cong might be trying to do. Those nationwide Buddhist protests in the South in 1963, which included the immolation of Quang Duc, were partly a response to the Diem government's ban on public displays of Buddhist iconography, Buddhist religious parades, to the closure of mounting numbers of pagodas, which seemed to be making life very difficult for those who wish to worship Buddhism in the traditional way, and also to rumours, just rumours, that Diem was poised to make Roman Catholicism the religion of the state. Now, back in the 50s, Graham Greene's journalism predicted something else. Predicted that politically, Diem might end up being ruined. And that was Greene's own word. Ruined by the United States, by the West generally. In 1955, on his last visit, Greene witnessed with some distaste the increasing numbers of US advisors who were crowding around Diem. This could do Diem no good in the eyes of Vietnamese nationalist opinion. He was looking, really from very early on, as if he was some kind of political plaything of the United States. Worse still, Green worried that the Americans might try and detach Diem from his Vietnamese roots and try and turn him into a cold warrior on the US or Western model, to pileize him, if you like. There he was, Green wrote in one 1955 article, there he was, surrounded by towering Americans who were droning on about global strategy. He was cocooned in security, cut off from his people when he should be walking in the rice fields, unprotected, learning the hard way how to be loved and obeyed. The two cannot be separated. Very Graham Greene payoff at the end of that line there. The towering Americans in the photographs, by the way, and Diem, it must be said, was a very diminutive figure in his own right, but some of you will recognize, Vice President Lyndon Johnson on the left, Kennedy's vice president. The man on the right, on the left-hand picture, is a US ambassador to South Vietnam called Fritz Nolting, and on the right is another very tall American ambassador to South Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge. By 1957, as Green kind of feared, communist propaganda in South Vietnam was referring to something called Mi Diem, literally America's Diem. His nationalist credentials do become eroded, if not ruined, over the next several years. And by 1963, when you add in his religious policies, the Kennedy administration reached a view that Diem was probably not the man to unite a majority of his countrymen and women, win over their hearts and minds in the struggle against the communist threat. And so the United States opts for what today would be called regime change. And so thanks in part to Malcolm Brown and his camera, and Malcolm Brown, for whom The Quiet American was such an inspiration, those photographs do seem to have made a deep impact on JFK. Well, I think it's about time to begin to land this thing. I did say that it wasn't exclusively American reporters. Clearly, you know, the Western world is reporting this more broadly. It's dominated by American reporters. A couple of quick examples of non-American reporters. This one here is Peter Arnett, a New Zealander and CNN pioneer. He called The Quiet American my guide, and call Graham Greene my guru. And this is our next fellow Antipodean, who will be recognisable maybe to a lot of people, and the Australian John Pilger, who described the Quiet American as a definitive reporting of events and attitudes which fueled the American war, and was regarded as such by many journalists who knew Vietnam, and who, like myself, would ritually hand over a battered copy to those who wanted to know how and why such an apparently pointless endeavor could be sustained. The United States finally withdrew from Vietnam in 1973. 58,000 Americans died. Estimates of Vietnamese deaths push the 2 million. It was a brutal war, whichever side you were on. The war itself ended in 1975 with the victory of the communists. Vietnam is united under communism. The final chaotic days, to bring Peter Arnett, looking rather older now, back in, were rather brilliantly chronicled by Peter Arnett in his book, Saigon Has Fallen. Then came reunification and the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, which is what we still have to this day. But, you know, even after the war, the Quiet American continued to have a hold on numbers of US war correspondents. In later years, Gloria Emerson loaned her personal copy of The Quiet American to a Vietnam veteran. What, the ex-soldier asked her, was there still to be learned from a novel like this now that the war itself was over? Almost everything, quote unquote, Emerson told him. For one thing, she said, it retained relevance as a warning to great powers, not exclusively America, to great powers, of the perils of overseas military interventions, premised on the notion that the power to destroy is the power to prevail. And for another reason, she said, it was a cautionary, even a morality tale, in how, in seeking to do good, an individual, a nation, can cause chaos if simplistic one-size-fits-all solutions are applied doggedly to very complicated problems. Well, as I really begin to close, I want to bring back David Greenway, whose reporting career continued right through Vietnam, out the other end, into and beyond 9/11 and the War on Terror. And Greenway has maintained that this novel retains incredible resonance. I came to Saigon, he wrote, thinking that the goal was correct, that we had to stop communism somewhere, first in Korea, now Vietnam. But I soon saw that it was much more complicated, that Graham Greene had been right, that the Americans were naive in their idealism, and that their good intentions could be sometimes destructive. And indeed, I've seen the ghost of Alden Pyle in the Green Zone in Baghdad, on the banks of the Tigris. And I ran into him in Afghanistan too, in the corridors of the American embassy in Kabul. In 1977, Michael Herr published Dispatches, a wonderful mix of his own reportage. He reported on the war for Esquire magazine, and also some frankly fantastical adaptations of what really happened. But nonetheless, Graham Greene read Dispatches in 1977, shortly after it came out. He read it with, quote, great interest, unquote. The rest of this quote is Greene himself. But I was rather put off by the opening part, which seemed to me to be too excitable, but Herr calmed down a bit later. I think when one is dealing with horrors, one should write very coldly. Otherwise, it reads like hidden boasting. Just see what a brave chap I am to have voluntarily put myself in the way of such experiences. To adapt Wordsworth, horror should be remembered in tranquility. Well, the full Wordsworth quote, I know there's at least one poet in the audience who might put me right if I got it wrong. You haven't heckled me this year, Richard. That's fine. Listen to 2 years ago. The full Wordsworth quote that Greene referred to goes, quote, poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. It takes its origin from emotion recollected in tranquility. Well, I think myself, as it seems, a good number of that generation of Vietnam War reporters I've put before you today, I think that The Quiet American does both. I think it does emotion and horror recollected in tranquility. So thank you for your attention. Thank you. Thank you very much. Very generous. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That was absolutely brilliant. Thrilling, analytic. Everything that we have seen you give here in previous festivals has been come out, has been brought forth again. If I had a football, I'd give it to you to take home.
So, okay, thank you.
That really was a thrilling talk. And I think we were all able to appreciate in quite careful and well-structured terms some of the really complicated history and context that informed Green's novel, which of course was absolutely terrific for all sorts of reasons, and I think you've given us new reasons to appreciate it all the more.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Now, there will be questions, I am sure. Would anyone like to ask David, please? The mic's on its way. Thank you.
In a way, you answered the question with your last few minutes, but as a historian, and I'm a literary critic by profession, are you giving this as an example of what could be a more general principle of the importance of fiction in analysis of historical, political, socio-political events? I mean, do you regard this as a good novel, or you talked about him also being a reporter, but arguably Graham Greene is primarily a novelist. That was, I think, his vocation. So could this be used as an example of a general principle of the importance of fiction, which is often, as it were, set against fact, mere fiction, in our recognition analysis of historical events?
Okay, it's a very good question. I'm a historian first and foremost. I'm not a literary critic. I'm a Green lover, but I'm a historian. And the reason I came to this in the first place is what I talked about my first visit, is that if so many people at the time and decades after it was published were looking at it as history or somehow informing them about the real past, maybe it was time to look at how good it was as history. Forget about a novel for a moment. And I still set my students that task. And aspects of it do work as history. He did live that war. He was there four times. But it is a piece of fiction as well. It's complicated because he brings real people in, like General Tay and so on and so forth. So what I find I use that novel for in my history teaching now is I use it to get my students feeling a sense of time and place. That it's easy enough for my students in their minds to be transported back to the American War. There's so many movies that you could name, much less on the French War. So reading The Quiet American as history students, and also discussing where it's at historically, I find is very helpful to getting them back into the early 50s down in Southeast Asia. When I used to do Britain Between the Wars, by the way, which I taught as a history module, I made my students read, when we were doing the build-up to 1939 and war, I would get them to read George Orwell, but a lesser-known George Orwell, Coming Up for Air, where one of the narrator, Bowling, isn't it? He's on his way to London to get a new set of false teeth fitted, and he's on the train staring out the window, and he's looking at the old lady hanging out her clean washing on the line, and there's a canary singing on the windowsill, and so on and so forth. And then he gets to imagining what that would look like when the bomber gets through, and he conjures up in his mind this horrible vision. And I think, you know, there is nothing that works so well for my students, for example, in terms of getting them to think in the terms of the late 30s, than a piece of fiction. There's plenty of videos they can read and history books and lectures they can go to. But I think literature, I've always felt literature has this power as an adjunct to history. So I'm very keen on that. I wouldn't say that I am trying to make any massive generalizations out of The Quiet American. What I am disturbed by is the numbers of young people that I teach these days, or the general public, that read a lot of historical fiction and uncritically imbibe this largely made up stuff. as somehow accurate. And I'm thinking of Hilary Mantel, for example. I get a nosebleed when I leave the 20th century. But I'm reliably informed by my colleagues who know a bit about that period of history, that the sources for Thomas Cromwell are actually very, very, very small, really, in terms of what he was like. And yet Hilary Mantel has made these two or three huge volumes out. And the number of people that I have encountered that their first engagement with history is through that is a little bit troubling for me. So, but I'm glad they're reading anything to do with history. So I've given a rather long answer, partly to mask the fact that I don't have this great extrapolation going on yet, but purely in The Quiet American, as a single novel that had massive resonance and massive relevance, it seemed worth exploring it from the angle I did, and I'm very glad I got into it, because I've now been able to shoot off in all these other hat-trick performing directions.
Yes, can we come to Kreiner and then Donald? If we take both questions, thank you, Kevin can answer. Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin, for that. It's great. Would you agree that Green also influenced the start of what have come to be called the new journalists or the new journalism? I'm thinking that The Quiet American actually marks a change in his style. And if we look at, say, the I think quite useful distinction that Cyril Connolly made in Enemies of Promise, where he talks about the vernacular and the Mandarin style, Green has moved on to a very much more pared-down style for The Quiet American. And it seems to me that the journalists imitated that as well as learning from the plot of The Quiet American.
I've not explored the journalists' writing from the angle that you laid out before us. But as you were saying what you were saying, I began to think, because I have read quite a lot of the stuff, and it's another avenue to explore whether stylistically they were aping him in some way. But then again, I can think of maybe a dozen Vietnam-era articles that Graham Greene himself wrote between 1951 and about 1955. Graham Greene was a reporter himself. He was a film critic himself. I think you can see adaptations in his style. It's always Greene, but he does move to shape himself within the parameters of what a film review needs to have in it, what a piece of journalism needs to have in it. It wouldn't surprise me if some of these reporters are in awe of the precision of his language and the way that he conveys so much with so little. So I'm sure that that's out there somewhere. It'd be interesting to know whether the Vietnam era student protesters, who also took this novel by 66, 67, it went a little bit viral amongst the anti-war movement as well, whether they modelled some of their essays on Green's economical style as well. But then again, they may not have been doing many essays, they may have been out protesting war, I don't know.
That's a good question, though.
I have a brief comment about the truth of the history of The Quiet American. All right, I go to a manicure shop near my home in Virginia, and nothing is spoken there but Vietnamese. All the women who were working there were Vietnamese. And so one day I decided to say to the person do you know Graham Greene's movie, The Quiet American? And she said, yes, on my husband's iPad. I see it two times. It is true. It is true.
Oh, that's very interesting. I thought you were going to say something else, but since you didn't, I might as well add it here. Graham Greene didn't get everything right in his journalism. I think there was, dare I say, a naivety to Graham Greene's views of the Vietnamese communists from time to time, and he lived long enough to see, I think, that he was rather wrong key aspects of the way he looked at the Vietnamese communist perspective. But interestingly, after you have the forced reunification of Vietnam in 1975, he goes rather quiet. He becomes a quiet Englishman on that subject. But I think when you put it in the scales, in a balancing sense, there is more profundity than naivety in the novel, and certainly its cultural impact is much greater than people allow.
Interesting.
It reaches to your manicurist.
Oh, we have two more questions. Thanks, Richard. So, John first, please.
Kevin, I was just wondering how open of the American government in allowing one access to the archives in the 1950s, which might talk about the their involvement with the Third Force. Have they been opened?
CIA archives, you can, under Freedom of Information, make all kinds of requests, and you do get an awful lot of redacted stuff. I did an article a few years ago on this when I was trying to see whether the General Tay thing was real or not. And there are snippets in US sources, but the British sources, the stuff you get at the National Archives in Kew, the reporting from the Saigon Embassy or Hanoi back to London, is kind of informative insofar as you have a British diplomat saying, I was speaking to the American consul the other day, and he confirmed what we suspected, that General Tay is being supplied, blah, 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 blah. Now, this is obviously top secret, and so on and so forth. So you can piece it together from that point of view. Historians who are writers on American intelligence and so on and so forth, I'm not that kind of historian, but when I say that General Tay was funded by the CIA, I'm going by now the research of those that have greater access to the relevant material that I have. But I was at the Foreign Office doing something on Monday, and the Foreign Office historian was there, and I always ask, any chance that MI6's archives might become open, you know, sort of to, you know, because one of us in this room maybe will hit the jackpot and get access to Graham Greene's MI6 file at some point. So I keep asking, and the door keeps being shut on me, and there's absolutely no chance of that. But yet, stuff bleeds through. But there is not enough to nail anything, absolutely 100%. That's the nature of Spooksville, I guess.
I think that will be the Holy Grail. That would be amazing. So final question from Richard, please. Thank you.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, Kevin, I love your research, the amazing things you do, and your ability to get into archives no one else can figure out even exists. I actually have an itsy-bitsy question. Is it possible for you to get back to your slide 2? Because there's a face in there of someone that I'm curious about.
Let's see if I can go backwards then, see if it works. No. Sorry, I need to. We'll get it back up from the start.
Maybe the next one.
Okay, going.
There.
Yeah, okay. You're going to say the Belgian bishop, Belgian missionary, are you?
I was wondering, is that the guy who was in the bell tower?
Yeah, I've been trying to piece that together. This is Willick or Willick.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've been mapping that. That's from probably the second visit, 1952, I think. It could be 53, though. And it's where he's been taken around to orphanages, and he's got these photographs he's been taking with Vietnamese kids and so on and so forth. He became quite friendly with a series of Belgian missionaries, one of whom, obviously, there's another one of those revelatory, I think Mike talked about them last night, character moments where you have two male characters, nearly always it seems, bearing their hearts. And he is personally very concerned about the fate of these Belgian missionaries in 1954-55 when partition happens and the Catholics of the North move south. About 700,000-800,000 of them move south. There's a window left open for 300 days after the French War ends. And a lot of these bishops get, a lot of these missionaries get trapped in the North, and Greene is very concerned about them. But actually trying to tag, as you might do on Facebook, to tag this guy, I found so far beyond my powers. I don't know, have you managed it?
No, I was just hoping that you had done, because I've seen that face in a couple of photographs.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, I was hoping you had caught it.
I haven't caught it, no.
Well, thank you anyway.
Thank you. I think we'll bring it to a close there. Well, that was another wonderful exploration of a really
huge and significant part of Greenland, and thank you for mapping that for us in so many different ways.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.